So it was nice to see all of you here early today. I hope that's because your meditation is going well and perhaps you're interested in hearing a little bit more about loving kindness. So it's a big subject, actually. It's one of my favorite subjects because loving kindness can actually complete the entire Eightfold Path, just as many methods can if practiced in context, as we discussed the first day, that this path is contextual and it must include virtue, it must include practices to calm and quiet the mind, and also leading to wisdom. So all of that is based on right view, some insight into suffering, and how suffering is universal. It doesn't leave anybody out, unfortunately, not even ourselves. And not even if we practice lots of metta, eventually, you know, still we're going to use that metta, that loving kindness, that resourced mind to understand suffering. But when we do it with a heart imbued with loving kindness, we have a kind of sense of resource, an inner resource from which to be able to see these truths without them kind of breaking us in a way. Right? So it's very resourcing for the mind. So I wanted to start with a little story, very short one, but it reminds me of my time in India. I lived in India for the best part of 15 years, so I like to say half of my blood is Indian. And I had a very strong karmic connection with that place. And once I was in Calcutta, and there were these beautiful flower markets all around the river, very kind of romantic in a sense, that this is where people would make huge garlands of flowers, and there were just literally mountains and mountains of flowers, and people would walk over the bridge with kind of huge backpacks full of flowers, just kind of strapped to their back, sort of coming over their head, and everywhere you went there were these beautiful flowers. And when I read the suttas, I read about a queen in the time of the Buddha called Mallika. And she was the chief wife of a king called King Pasenadi. And unlike most queens in those days, she actually started her life as a simple flower girl. So I could kind of imagine her there, you know, making the garlands of flowers on the banks of the river in Calcutta or wherever she lived, maybe on the banks of the Ganges River. And one day the king went into town and saw this girl. And he thought, she has to be my wife for some reason. So he took her back with him. I think women didn't have a lot of choice in those days. And she became his chief wife. But also, she was a very wise queen and she had a lot of faith in the Buddha. So although she was very loving towards her husband, and he looked up to her a lot, he was also one of the donors of the Buddha in those days. One day he was upset because he saw her looking out of the window and she was gazing with adoration at the Buddha and his monks coming past. And the king got jealous. And remember, in those days, this is dangerous because the king has all the power, and the kings in those days could execute people by chopping off their heads. So his chief wife looking at the Buddha in a way that caused jealousy for him was quite a serious issue. So he went to the queen, he went to Mallika, and he said, "Mallika, who do you love most in the world, me or the Buddha?" Imagine. So now she has to think on her feet. And as I said, she was a very wise queen, and she thought quickly and said, "Truthfully, more than the both of you, I love myself. More than the both of you, I love myself." And the king was struck by this and actually realized that it was the same for him. He actually loved himself more than he loved anyone in the world. And this is where the practice of metta can begin. Many times we don't think we have any self-love. We actually think we're rather down on ourselves. We don't care about ourselves. We have a lot of self-critical voices. But the fact that you're all here now is a testament to the fact that you do love yourself. You do care for your own well-being. And for many years, I've been a little bit confused by a phrase that's used a lot in the insight traditions, kind of more secular Buddhist traditions that have become popular in England anyway, where they quote the Buddha as saying, if you search the whole world, you won't find anyone more dear to you than you yourself. And in those traditions, people love to say this to point out that we are really important, right? And that we need to develop self-love. But I looked up this phrase and it's actually, that's only half of it. So I'll read the whole thing, which gives a different perspective. And this is, I think, from the Samyutta Nikaya 3.8. It says SN, it could also be the Sutta Nipata, I'm not sure. But the actual quote goes like this. Having explored every quarter, that means every part of the world, with the mind, one finds no one dearer than oneself. But this is the different part. Likewise for others, each holds themselves dear. So one who cares for their own welfare would harm no other. You see the difference here. The Buddha's actually asking us to empathize with others as though they were just as dear as ourselves. So we're no more important, we're no less important, but understanding what we would like to experience in our life, we can understand others wish the same. Just as everybody wishes for their own happiness and well-being, just as we wish for that, everyone wishes for the same. Just as we don't like to be discriminated against or judged or unfairly treated, nor does anybody else. Just as we want to live in safety and in peace, so does everybody else. And so this is the beginning of metta. You know, like everything else in the path, it stems from right view. And that right view is that all beings suffer and all beings desire their own happiness. And when we really understand this and we stop kind of dividing ourselves from others in a negative or a positive way, then metta has a chance to flourish. And metta is actually, I like the translation love, just straight out love. But unfortunately, the word love has become very corrupted in our societies. And often it's taken to mean something more akin to attachment. And that's what Mallika meant in this story when she said, more than the both of you, I love myself. Right? Actually, we don't really love another. We love the way they make us feel. If we feel good around a person, we say we love that person. Most of the time, we just love the way they make us feel. If we no longer feel good around that person, or the amount of times we feel uncomfortable or ill at ease around that person outweighs the happiness we get, then we don't love them anymore, right? And here I want to make a caveat immediately. This does not stand for abusive situations. So don't feel that because of this we have to stay in situations where we don't feel good and we actually feel that we're badly treated. That's a different thing. But just to start seeing that our love is conditional. And the love that the Buddha is talking about is something called unconditional love. I care for your well-being, your peace, your harmony, your spiritual progress, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, no matter what. I really love this phrase with loving kindness, no matter what. It's a sense of unconditionality. And it takes a long time to be able to really rely on that kind of love. You know, I'm fortunate in my life to have had probably at least two or three very deeply loving relationships, mostly with a teacher or with a friend. And I grew up with a best friend. We were born, I think, in the same hospital, 8 hours apart. And we grew up together from the age of about four. Apparently, when I met her, it was at one of our mutual friends, or who was to become a mutual friend's house. And we were just sitting there together on a table. I still have a photograph. Little four-year-olds, one blonde, one brunette, looking really sweet. And I said to her, when we go to school, I'll look after you. Because she was even more shy than me. I was quite shy, but she was really shy. And we grew up together and know each other so well. You know, we went to India together when we were 19. Before that, we went to Israel. We got up to, you know, plenty of interesting stuff and also came to the Dhamma at a similar time. And now she serves on my trust, on my board of trustees. And it's the kind of friendship where no matter where we go or what we do, when we meet again, it's just as though no time has passed, you know. And if I tell her something that's happening to me, she sees it through the lens of knowing who I am, knowing how I might interpret things, giving me the benefit of the doubt. And truly caring for my well-being. And I think it goes both ways. And this is such a beautiful expression or example of unconditional love. You know, a friendship that just kind of grows together with another person and has no ill will involved. I don't think we've ever even had an argument, although arguments are fine as well. And the other really wonderful example is with my teachers, first my preceptor in Myanmar and also Ajahn Brahm. And one of the expressions of loving kindness, he doesn't make these expressions very often. You know, if you have it, you have to kind of print it out and put it on your notice board. But he said something like, I'm always around for you, always keeping my mind on the lookout to make sure you're safe and prospering. And this is also an expression of unconditional love. It has no desires for itself. It just wants to look out for another person and make sure that that person's doing well at the physical level, the material level, emotionally, and also spiritually. And this is how we develop our unconditional love. So it's committed to promoting the true welfare of ourselves and others, no matter who they are. And in the Buddha's teachings, it's known as one of the Brahma Viharas. So these are translated as divine abidings, places that we can frequently resort to and rest our mind in. So as we cultivate more and more loving kindness in our hearts, it becomes our inclination. It becomes easy to resort to a place that's resourcing and full of love. And yet, if that seems far away from you, the Buddha also says that even if you develop thoughts of loving kindness, feelings of loving kindness, for a finger snap, for that long. There's another one where he says, for the length of time it takes to pull a cow's udder. I don't know if you pull cow's udders here, or if anybody ever has, but it wouldn't be very long, right? Just a simple thought of loving kindness can cut through so much ill will. And that one thought of loving kindness is more beneficial from giving charity to 200 people or something like this. And I thought about that afterwards, like, how can that be? You know, surely it's not so important what is in our mind. It has to manifest in action, right? And that's true. Loving kindness will and should manifest in action. But I think the idea is that if we're dealing with the roots of our mind, if we're dealing with the motivation of our mind at the root level by undermining ill will, then we're much more likely to be able to serve others in a really powerful way. We're not just going to give food to 200 people. We're going to have a life dedicated to service in whatever way we can. And it's going to be relevant to the situation at hand. There's a lovely little quote from Khalil Gibran, I think. I don't usually quote Sufi mystics, but this is really nice. He says, work is love made visible. Work is love made visible. So loving kindness has an action to it. There has to be a response, but it starts in the heart. And love is something that just gives of itself. It just gives for the sake of giving without expecting anything in return. This is another aspect of the unconditional sense of loving kindness. We give without expecting anything in return. And it's important to keep this in mind when we practice loving kindness, because sometimes we think, I'll practice it so that, right? I'll practice it so I'll be full of happiness and I'll never feel ill will again. And when you actually sit down on the cushion and start practicing loving kindness, you realize it's quite challenging because we have so many obstacles. We have so many blockages to love. Sometimes we're just afraid to really open the heart. Other times we find that rather than loving kindness, we start to move into worry and attachment and, you know, anxiety. Sometimes we just feel irritated. And that's okay, because loving kindness highlights the obstacles to it. You know, just as when we want to develop calm meditation, we're going to come in contact with the restless mind. It's inevitable, right? Because this is the thing you need to be calming or learn to understand before it naturally calms on its own. And loving kindness is also inclusive. I gave a whole talk on this in Finland recently. It was like a weekend meta retreat called The Radically Inclusive Nature of Love. And I really love that idea, to be radically inclusive, to include people that maybe you don't even know about, maybe have completely opposite political views, people that you may read about in the newspapers and become vilified, people that you've never tried to empathize with, right? Imagine if we could really be that inclusive and create societies based on that inclusivity, where no one felt left out, where the vulnerable were cared for, even more than those people who are already doing well, or by those people who are already doing well. If we could share our privilege with those who have less, what a beautiful world we would create. Something much more equitable, much more fair, and a place where everyone could thrive. And I think this is part of the wisdom of love. You know, when we stop judging others and we start understanding that people manifest the way they are due to conditions, that's all, then we have more capacity, more motivation to actually see that those conditions are conducive for everyone to thrive. So it's radically inclusive, and it's known as Sima Sambeda in Pali, which means something that breaks the boundaries between one another, but also breaks the boundaries between what we include within ourselves, right? So we start to actually increase what we are able to bring into our awareness. We start to increase our capacity to hold our emotional world. So we don't just say, okay, I like this part of myself, but that part of myself, that should stay over there. I can't deal with that part right now. That is bad. That needs to be changed, you know. So we don't stigmatize other people. We don't stigmatize our emotional world. We start to include everything. And there was a lovely poem which I usually quote when I'm teaching on loving kindness, but it's just really great. And this was when Ajahn Brahm had participated in the ordination of bhikkhunis for the first time in 2009. And this happened in Perth, and I guess Bhantinita was there at the time. I don't think I'd quite met Ajahn Brahm yet, actually. I met him the following year, having no idea of what had gone before. But anyway, it's interesting, isn't it, when we say something was controversial. Let's say some people caused a controversy over it. Not Ajahn Brahm, not the Sangha in Perth. They were all in agreement that this was a good thing to do, to give full ordination to women who wanted to live the monastic life. So there was a lot of harmony and agreement on that in Perth, but it did create waves in other parts of the world, and particularly in very patriarchal communities where women had only so far, and still it remains, only been allowed to take the novice ordination. So unfortunately, because Ajahn Brahm had gone ahead and done what he thought was right, some other communities were quite upset with him. Maybe it showed them up. And they called him to Thailand and gave him a telling off in front of all the Thai elders, and they, gathered lots and lots of senior monks, and they basically told him off that he shouldn't have done that, and that unless he actually announced that the ordination was invalid, then he would be no longer part of their club, let's say, no longer part of that particular lineage of monasteries. So in the Buddha's day, there was no such thing as a lineage of monasteries. Every place was independent, and for good reason, so that things like this can't happen. But unfortunately, as we were saying last night, the Buddhism and the Dhamma are sometimes two different things. Religion and Dhamma are sometimes two different things. And when things become a tradition, then it's like you're either in or you're out. So anyway, they threw him out. And I think it was a bit of a shock, but he refused to go back on his, on the truth, basically. It was a moment of truth. You know, they asked, well, are these nuns fully ordained or not? If you say they're not, you can stay in the club. But of course he couldn't do that because the ordination was valid. So he said, no, these are bhikkhunis, you know, so be it. So sadhu, 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 because there have been many bhikkhunis since then, and without his integrity and courage, I wouldn't be here right now, and nor would the monastery we have, and nor would the opportunity for my trainees. So they threw him out, and he got back to Perth, and then on his website for a while there was this beautiful little poem, and I hope that some of them read it and took it to heart, because it said, they drew a circle that shut me out. Rebel, heretic, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took them in. It's so beautiful, isn't it? It's not fighting. It's not getting revenge. It's just widening the circle of what we're willing to accept. And taking the moral high ground, not in a snotty superior way, but in a beautiful way, love and wit. Metta is also playful. This thing with the teddy bears, you know, it's also a part of loving kindness. And I've seen my own teacher, our teacher also, in a sense, treat us all like kids, in a very beautiful sense, in a playful way. You know, understanding that, yeah, we're human beings, we have to try to be kind of show that we have it all together, but actually most of us just have a very innocent heart and you know, we just respond to a bit of playfulness, a bit of care, just to a simple story or a simple joke. So loving kindness has this aspect of joy. And to get onto some of the other purposes of love, which I will do, one of the main purposes is that happiness. Loving kindness is a very powerful way to develop the kind of ethical happiness that Bhantanito was talking about yesterday. It's not just happiness. It's not just smiling and laughing as a measure of that happiness. You know, of course, we have to use a measure, right? And this graph was very interesting yesterday, but it talked about smiling and laughing or something like that. And how long is it since you have? Well, for me, when I've been on retreat for, say, 3 months, I don't smile and laugh. I'm on my own. Sometimes maybe I do in the early morning if I get giggly or a lot of PTs coming up, there might be a bit of giggliness. But some of the happiest times in my life have been when I've felt a deep inner happiness that's different from what we call hedonic happiness. Yeah, the happiness based on sensuality or just sheer pleasure in the body, right? So the kind of happiness that we develop through loving kindness is really deeply ethical and very connected with ourselves and our own humanity. And because of this, it can be a powerful way to get your meditation going. And to keep it going. You know, some people use metta, loving kindness, as their main vehicle, their main practice. And I think it's a wonderful practice to make your main vehicle. It has many, many strengths. One of the immediate strengths you'll find is that it really is effective in overcoming unwholesome thought because you're using substitution. You're planting in a thought of loving kindness, which keeps out thoughts of ill will. The Buddha actually says it's impossible to have a thought of ill will simultaneously with a thought of kindness. That's kind of powerful, right? You're putting in kind of an antiviral in the mind. It's not only that it dislodges the thought, but it actually prevents it coming in. So, and the more you're infused with thoughts of loving kindness, the less chance these thoughts of ill will have to come inside. There's no space for them. And if they do come, you notice them immediately. It's like, what's that? That doesn't belong in my mind. Even then, you don't need to react very strongly to it because you're so resourced. It just can come and you barely notice it. It kind of bounces right off. So this happiness is one of the really powerful ways that loving kindness can help us in our meditation. And loving kindness tends to develop happiness a little bit earlier on in the process compared to breath meditation. So breath meditation tends to bring about peace more quickly. It's also very powerful in overcoming thinking, if it works for you. Different people, again, have different inclinations. But if you go about breath meditation properly and allow the mind to settle, to develop this present moment awareness, to find contentment in the present, to sit back, if you like, and allow the mindfulness or the knowing part of the mind to increase and to gain energy and strength, then when the breath arises in the mind, it's fairly easy to hold. You don't really have to hold it. It just rises in the mind and you welcome it in. And then it can make the mind very, very peaceful to the point where the breath starts to disappear. And from that place, piti, happiness can arise. So generally in breath meditation, the peace comes first and the happiness comes later. Whereas in metta meditation, the happiness comes first. And because of that happiness, there's a momentum, there's a motivation to continue to meditate. And after a while, when you're satiated with that happiness, then the peace arises as a result. And it's a very beautiful peace because it's been purified from ill will. The special ethical function of loving kindness is to overcome ill will. This is one of its other main strengths. So It can be a challenging practice precisely because of this, precisely because you'll be facing the obstacles to love, the obstacles to metta in the heart. And to the degree that ill will is absent, the metta can flourish. The more that metta flourishes, the less opportunity the afflictive states that cause you to suffer have to arise. So as we develop metta, more and more ill will is overcome. And not only ill will, often it's a little known fact that metta is also incredibly powerful in overcoming fear, which is another kind of ill will. You know, it's another kind of aversion or resisting or negativity to what's arising. Oftentimes, fear arises in response to fear itself. So it's what we call double dukkha, right? You have fear and then you're afraid of the fear. Or you have anger coming up, you get angry with the anger, etc., etc. But these kind of aspects of ill will can be much more subtle than that. Sometimes they're just a kind of very subtle resistance to the practice, or a resistance. Sometimes it's easy to see in the body. It can be a resistance to the painful feelings in the body. So you're meditating and trying to be aware. And this has happened to me many times. I'm thinking that I'm just being aware and, you know, that I'm being objective and there's some sort of physical or maybe emotional anxiety or something that I'm experiencing. And after 1 or 2 hours working with this and thinking, yeah, I'm just being aware, I realize that there's this very subtle kind of, if I'm aware and I just stay a little bit away from you, maybe you'll go away. It's like there's just this little bit of hardness kind of tensing up against what's difficult. And as soon as you notice that, if you add loving kindness, I remember a specific time I added compassion because that seemed the most appropriate response. It was a kind of anxiety in the tummy that was related a little bit to my gastric condition. So something that, you know, was a little bit difficult to deal with. And I realized, oh, this is hard. And just added a sense of warmth and genuine inclusion, almost like a mental hug. It's really hard to get words for this because it's a very subtle shift in perception or coloring of perception. It's like if mindfulness is, I don't know, pale blue, you add a little bit of, or maybe you change it to a little bit orange or something. It's very subtle. It's like a sunset. Yesterday in the kitchen, there was a beautiful light and in the dining room, and there was this kind of orange glow. And that's how it can sometimes feel. Sometimes you can relate these emotions of loving kindness or compassion to a color, and that's really helpful. So anyway, I added this little bit of compassion, and just within an instant, everything relaxed, everything opened up, and pure joy and piti, pasadi, the whole thing started coursing through the body and went into the mind. So sometimes, you know, there is ill will present and we don't know it until we add a little bit more kindness. So try adding kindness, and if some obstacle disappears or dissolves or things become softer, more spacious, more expansive, that's a good sign that there was some resistance, there was some ill will involved. Ill will is quite a strong word, but it also manifests as boredom, sometimes drowsiness. You know, we sleep because we don't really like our life, we don't really enjoy it. In the Australian prisons where Ajahn Brahm used to visit, they used to say, an hour of sleep is an hour off your sentence. And that's sometimes how we feel when we're depressed. We think if I just turn over and go back to sleep, I won't have to deal with the day ahead. You know, and so that happens sometimes in meditation as well. Most of the time it's because you're genuinely exhausted when you come to retreat, but some of the time it's because the mind's not engaging. It has some aversion to just simply being aware, being alive. And if we add a bit of loving kindness or compassion to that, we'll find that the mind will open up and start to see much more. So these specific strengths of loving kindness are to develop happiness, to overcome ill will, and also to gain samadhi. In the Metta Sutta, which actually it's not the Metta Sutta, it's the benefits of Metta. It's another sutta. The Buddha speaks about all the different benefits. Some of them are related to sleep, as we discussed yesterday. One sleeps easily, doesn't have bad dreams, and wakes up refreshed with loving kindness, especially if you practice it before you go to bed. And also when you wake, you'll start the day primed for happiness and for whatever obstacles and challenges you're going to meet. But as well as that, it says that you are protected from poisons, from weapons, in other words, from other people's ill will, or animals even. Animals and devas and human beings find you dear, so they like to be with you. You know, there's some little dogs here. You can, don't worry if they walk away, it's just because they're hungry or something. But if they come and let you stroke them, it's probably because they know you're a safe place, right? They know that you have a lot of metta, you have a lot of loving kindness. And it's a way to develop loving kindness as well. So you become dear to the devas, that's the higher beings in the heavenly realms, and also to animals and human beings. In other words, you have a lot of friends. And it's a very important thing to develop loving kindness when you have to be in our role, which is to teach the Dhamma. I don't know about Bhantinito, but I was absolutely averse and terrified of public speaking when I began, to the point that I thought, long before I was asked to teach, I thought, it's a shame, but I'll never be able to teach because I just can't do that. I can't get up in front of people and teach. It's impossible. I can't even speak in a group of four or five people. It's so embarrassing. I can speak one-on-one, but not in a group, you know. And the way that I got over that was to develop loving kindness and to get in touch with a deeper motivation, which is not to imagine that I'm sitting here on display, everybody's assessing me and figuring out whether what I say makes sense. It wasn't about me. It was about giving. It's about my love for the Dhamma, you know, my genuine love. I mean, I really love the Dhamma. It's my whole life, and it always has been since I heard the Dhamma. And a genuine wish to give, again, without expecting anything in return. So the first time I was asked to teach, I actually refused and went into a complete state of shock and panic. And then I realized if I'm going to go with that, I'm never going to teach. So I changed my mind and I told the senior nun at the time, okay, I'll do it. It was only 20 minutes, a 20-minute reflection. And I went to my kuti and meditated on the joy of giving, on what it's like to just have the perception of giving without expecting anything in return. And after practicing in this way, I thought, great, I'm going to give a talk on giving. And it was such joy because I had personal experience right from that afternoon on what it's like to, instead of grasp and worry and be concerned about oneself, to just give and to focus on the others and not on oneself. And so nowadays, that's what I try and do. Even this morning, I thought, okay, I've got to convince everybody that it's good to develop loving kindness. And then when I changed that to, no, I'm going to speak with my friends about this beautiful topic that I genuinely revere, that was a completely different feeling. I'm going to just speak to my friends. You know, we're all going to just get inspired from thinking about what loving kindness means. That's all we really have to do, right? Even just hearing words of loving kindness can start those feelings arising in the heart. I hope that's happening for some of you. Yeah, because it's a beautiful topic. One that you don't read about in the news, right? You read about all sorts of rubbish in the newspapers and online, all the fear-mongering stuff, but loving kindness, very rarely, very, very rarely. And yet there are so many people engaged in acts of loving kindness around the clock. So these are some of the benefits of loving kindness, but the one that I'm coming to, which is important for us on retreat, is that one who develops lots of loving kindness easily becomes still. The translation is usually easily gains samadhi, and I try and move away from words around gain and attain, but basically it means the mind will be able to settle itself and go inside, mainly because your mind is a friendly place to be. Your mind is soft. You know, when we have a hard mind, a brittle mind, a mind of ill will, it's like you're trying to kind of push your breath inside a stone, inside a rock. But when the mind is soft, it's like a sponge for the breath. The breath just simply, the mind soaks up the breath. Yeah, it just receives the breath. And the mind becomes expansive and wide. And this is another quality of loving kindness, that the mind becomes wide, it becomes resourced. So how do we start to practice loving kindness with a view to deepening states of stillness and ultimately our wisdom capacity, our wisdom faculty? And there are different ways. As I said, one aspect of loving kindness is action, right? Actually acting with thoughts is mental action, but speech and physical action in the world. And I'm not going to focus on that today, but another one is intention. Having an intention of loving kindness, developing loving kindness as a wise way of relating to whatever arises in our mind. And I'd like to focus on this and also cultivation. So the two aspects of loving kindness that I feel are really indispensable to our practice life are using loving kindness as a way of relating to whatever arises in our mind, in our body, in our life, and loving kindness as a intentional cultivation, development of wholesome states. In other words, loving kindness as a main practice leading towards jhana. And maybe some of you can experience that in this retreat, who knows? So metta as a way of relating is an indispensable tool, and it's part of right intention. So this comes straight after right view in the gradual training and in the Eightfold Path. Again, the three right intentions, which are your kind of absolutely everyday tool. You can use this in every situation. If this is all you take away from this retreat, you're sorted, okay? The intention of loving kindness, the intention of compassion, and the intention to let go, to give, to renounce. It's one and the same. So with these three intentions, you're making good karma. This is actually the karma that the Buddha's talking about. When he talks about making good karma, he means making karma based on these three motivations: loving kindness as opposed to ill will, compassion as opposed to cruelty, and renunciation, giving up, letting go, as opposed to attaching, desire, craving. Yeah. And one paradigm I find really useful that Ajahn Brahm teaches a lot is this idea of the knower and the known. Last night, Ajahn Nito talked a bit about this. He mentioned about getting into this kind of seat, sitting your bum down in the place of the knowing part of the mind, if you like. I mean, this is an analogy, right? But it's like there's an active part of the mind and there's a passive part of the mind, and the knowing part of the mind just observes. So in this particular paradigm, we have the knowing or the knower and the known, which are the objects of the mind. And the important thing there is that there is a space. There is a space between the two. And this space is where the hindrances arise. The hindrances arise in response to something that is known, right? So for example, you see a person who you feel attracted towards. So the knowing is knowing that there's this person there, and then the person is attractive. And between the two, you might have lust arising. So this is a hindrance in that case. Yeah, or there might be ill will arising between you and another person. So only when we kind of understand that there is a gap there, we realize we have a choice. And instead of allowing ill will or lust to arise in that place, instead we put loving kindness. Yeah, so in this space between the knowing and the known, we can add loving kindness to the way we're aware. And that, again, can just mean softening the texture of that awareness a little bit. Sometimes it's enough just to notice what's there, and you'll find it disappears on its own. But other times we can intentionally bring more warmth, more kindness, more friendliness. And also the word respect is a part of loving kindness. So for example, if you have an emotion that you generally think is kind of unwanted, you know, you stigmatize it. Maybe it's anxiety, something you really want to get rid of, and you think, oh gosh, not this again. You know, instead of this, don't try and get rid of it. Just give it some love. Just give it some compassion and see what it needs. See what kind of attitude, what kind of way of relating just tends to soften it a little bit. So it's an experiment in a way. And again, it's an antidote to ill will, because ill will is like a poison for the mind. So it's like when you add these beautiful intentions between the knower and the known, they act like a kind of antidote or even a preventative medicine, something like this. So they really offset the aversive or harmful effects of these hindrances. And again, sometimes you might not know these hindrances are there until you try it, right? And if you do add that little bit of loving kindness and you find that the problem softens a little bit, then you can know that aversion or fear or ill will was present. One really easy way to practice this is on the body. And just recently, I had the opportunity for this because the body gives us instant feedback. We immediately know whether the body's at ease or not, right? It's something that you can really feel. And most of the time in my life, I'm going from one email to the next, one Skype call or Zoom call to the next, one subject to the next, and then another person in real life, and then another email. And it is really a kind of onslaught for the senses. And sometimes I come down for my lunch and my head is pounding. I guess also not being used to quite so much stimulation for most of my life, but I think for anybody this would be a lot. So I came down on this particular day and my head was pounding even more than usual. And I realized that behind the headache was this kind of momentum, this kind of force of just pushing myself on, you know, pushing myself through to the next thing, to the next thing. It was like this really strong energy. And as soon as I noticed that, I sat down to meditate before the meal, which I often do. So we meet for the meal and then we do some blessings. But before that, I just ask everybody to settle themselves in the body and just establish a sense of presence and notice the silence around us and just generate a little bit of gratitude for the donors of the food, etc. So it's also my excuse to feel that I'm out of fight flight and into this kind of rest and digest. So I just practiced and I noticed the headache and I realized that I was kind of trying to push through. And instead of that, just softened to the headache and just invited that bit of loving kindness in. And it only took 10 minutes for all this tension and pressure to start to dissolve. And after 10 minutes, the headache was totally gone. I doubt very much this would have been the case without loving kindness. You know, if I would have just noticed, okay, there's pressure, let me just look at it, I'm not really sure. But there was a response, there was an emotional response of, oh, you know, it's intuitive, actually. It's not that we're doing something. It's kind of an intuitive response based on empathy. And this is why it's good to develop that sense of empathy in our lives. And then we know what things need, how to soothe them, how to calm them, how to soften our whole experience. There was another experience I had. This is more about letting things be, because as I said, loving kindness is not always that active. But we can also let things be by simply giving them space. And this was a experience I had in Burma, walking up to this incredible stupa that is kind of above, it's been built above the city. It's this incredible golden pagoda called the Shwedagon Pagoda. And it's huge. It has this big marble platform above the city and four huge staircases going up. And if you manage to make it to the top of one, you're just literally drenched with sweat because it's such a hot country and it's really quite a climb. And you get up there and you feel like you're in a different kind of realm. It's just pulsating with Dhamma energy. And there are many people kind of chanting and meditating and paying respects to all the various Buddha statues there out of genuine devotion to the teachings. And I went up there to meditate, but unfortunately there's only a marble floor and I have very bony ankles. So I sat myself down. I thought, gosh, this is going to hurt. You know, my bones were literally just crushed against the marble. But I sat there and just let it be. And I just tuned up to the energy of the place. And within a few minutes, I could barely feel my ankles. I felt like I was literally sitting in the clouds. And the whole thing just relaxed. So sometimes if we just let things be without kind of worrying about them, without fighting them, you know, here I've managed to get up to this beautiful place, which, you know, most people will never visit in their life. I can either kind of focus on my ankle pain or I can just focus on something else. Let the ankle pain be, leave it alone, and actually it will vanish all on its own. So these are some of the ways that we can use ways of relating wisely to really change our relationship to our inner world, and of course to each other as well. When we meet each other, when we speak with each other, sometimes we don't need to say very much, but if we just hold the space in a warm-hearted way, that can be already very comforting to a friend who's maybe going through grief. However, there is a cultivation part to the metta, so I just want to end by talking about this, because this is what we were doing yesterday to some extent. We did start by just being aware of the body and adding some kindness there to the way we're aware, but then we can take it further and actually cultivate states of loving kindness. So there are different ways to do this, and most of the time in the suttas, it talks about simply spreading loving kindness in every direction. So the emphasis is not on particular individuals. The emphasis is on a kind of spatial expansion, just expanding the loving kindness that we have in our heart through our wholesome actions of body, speech, and mind, and spreading it out into the world in every direction. And the Buddha says that it's like a trumpet. When you blow the trumpet from the top of a mountain, it just spreads indiscriminately everywhere. I also think of it as like the sun, you know, that just shines impartially on all beings. Wherever the sun rises, the light just starts to spread. The higher the sun goes, the more it spreads across the whole world. But the challenge with this, of course, is that many of us don't have that much loving kindness to begin with, to start spreading. And also, we can spread loving kindness all over the world, but there might be someone in your life that you still are excluding, that you still have issues with, that you still haven't really dealt with your own aversion towards. And a nice example of one of my friends in Perth, she told me that she was meditating on loving kindness one day in this way and thinking she was doing very well, until her father knocked on the door and said, "Excuse me, time for dinner," or whatever. And she kind of tried to ignore him. She carried on sending metta, maybe happy, sending metta. And then he carried on knocking on the door, and eventually she opened the door. "I'm practicing metta meditation." "Right," he said. "Okay, that's metta meditation, is it?" Because he was a Buddhist as well. So sometimes that isn't enough. That doesn't really work. And so there's another way to practice, which is based on the teachings in the Visuddhimagga, which is a commentarial text. I forget the time. It's about 500 years after the Buddha, possibly, or 1,000 years. I'm not sure. But it's a manual of meditation, which has a lot of useful stuff. And one of the things that I find really useful in this book is this idea of spreading metta systematically to different categories of being. And traditionally this starts with oneself, because that's supposed to be the easy person. And I think in many Asian cultures it is the easy person, because they don't grow up so much with an idea of self-hate and guilt. Maybe this is something we inherit from the Christian tradition, this idea of being like a sinner before you're even born, I suppose, or at least by the time you're born. So for them, the self is the easy person. For us, it's often not. So we start where it's easy. So in this sequence, it's the self and then the benefactor or the loved person. Can be both, the benefactor and the loved person. A benefactor, I suppose, is someone who's really helped us in our life. Someone who's an elder, maybe a teacher, maybe a spiritual figure in our life. But a friend or a loved person works just as well. And then we move on to a person that we have not particularly strong feelings towards, either positively or negatively. So this is traditionally called the neutral person. But remember, these people are not loved or neutral or bad or anything like that. It's our feelings towards them that are the key. So we pick someone who we're quite impartial towards. And then we pick someone that we don't like very much. Sometimes this is called the enemy or the disliked person, but don't choose a sworn enemy for this, because that's really challenging. But just choose someone that maybe you've had some conflict with, maybe you're shutting out, maybe you don't like very much. You might not have met them, it could be a political leader, it could be someone who brings up aversion in you, and you understand that this person is just the trigger for your aversion, but with aversion in your heart, you're never going to be happy. So it's worthwhile to remove it. It doesn't mean you have to bring this person into your life. It doesn't mean you have to live with them or you have to get married again to them or anything like that. It just means, some people are giggling about that. It just means that you don't want to allow hate to harbor in your mind because it's impeding your own happiness and well-being. So we start with the self, for example. Say we start with ourselves. And for many of us, we find that we are our own worst critic. I had an email recently from a friend, and they said to me, even if Ajahn Brahm would tell me that I'm a good person 20 times and tell me that I'm a bad person only once, I would believe that I'm a bad person. And I thought that was a bit of a shame. But actually, they're not unusual in that. That's actually a statistic that we need to hear praise about 20 times more than blame for it to sink in. One bad word discounts 20 good words. Isn't that sad in a way? So by sending metta to ourselves, we're moving from our self-critic to an advocate for our own well-being. And it's interesting to see where we are just preventing ourselves from enjoying happiness. Sometimes this comes up in meditation, even on the breath. You might not be practicing loving kindness. You might not realize there's aversion in the mind. But when it comes to the point where the breath starts to disappear, and normally you start to experience some happiness and joy, you just don't feel it. You just don't feel that happiness. You just don't allow yourself to feel that happiness. Or the happiness starts and you think, oh, no, I haven't deserved it. I didn't earn it. You know, this is not for me. I'm not supposed to be happy. I don't know if anybody's experienced this, but I have. I've had this feeling where, like, after one really, really powerfully blissful meditation, the whole thing started again. I could feel it happening just instantly from sitting down and I hadn't even gotten to the breath. And I thought, oh, no, not now. And I just closed it down. I think I felt I hadn't earned it yet. It wasn't the right time. Or maybe I didn't quite trust it yet. Something like this. But this is a kind of ill will towards ourselves. And we deny ourselves happiness based on guilt, based on maybe not forgiving ourselves for whatever we think we've done wrong in the past. If only we could realize that we didn't have much choice. We did what we did based on what we knew then. Based on the conditions we were faced with then, based on the wisdom we had then. That's not our fault or our lack. So it needs a bit of self-forgiveness. And this is why this journey is a challenge. This journey is quite a deep one, but a very powerfully transformative one as well. So for many of us, we might wish to start with the loved person, which is what I did yesterday. The loved person or the benefactor, someone who's looked out for us in the past, who we feel happy around, who we feel brings us joy in our life, just to think of them. And we may immediately get a sense of happiness. But yeah, I was teaching a metta retreat in America, and I remember one woman chose her daughter. And then she started getting so much worry coming up. And one of the worries, which was quite heartbreaking really, was that maybe she would end up being the kind of mother that her mother had been to her, and she would end up harming her daughter the way she'd been harmed. So it turned into really quite a difficult meditation, but also healing, because then she could work with that and let go of some of that and realize that she was not her mother and it was a completely different situation, and also realize that this worry she had towards her daughter was actually alienating her. You know, one of the ways that I've started to experience the difference between attachment and genuine love is if someone's very attached to me and I tell them that I'm upset, they tend to worry and try and fix it. Whereas if someone just has unconditional love, they tell me, and this is Ajahn Brahm, he said these words, he's looked at me, even in times when I've been struggling, and said, I'm not worried about you at all. You have my trust and respect. And I'm like, wow, I have your trust and respect? Like, even when I'm really upset and you're telling me you respect me, you trust me, you're not worried about me, wow. And that's just so amazing because it gives me space to be. It's like I don't have to take his burden of worrying about me on as well, you know, but he can just hold that space. So worry can come up when we do it towards someone we're too attached to. And that's why working with the loved person is very interesting, because we see where love is tainted by clinging, by owning, by possessing, and it ceases to be unconditional love. Then we go for the neutral person. And this is really interesting because if you think about it, most people in the world are actually neutral in the sense that we don't know most people. They're strangers. We don't have particular incentives to get along with them. We don't have particular expectations. We don't have a wish for reciprocity at all. So when we can develop love to the people like this, it can be simpler, it can be harder to sustain because we don't have as much interest in this person. So it shows us also where our love expects something in return. But also when we do develop it, it can be very pure. It can be very expansive because it reaches so many beings. And it's interesting, you might start to find that if you do meet one of these people who you are quite impartial towards, you start to see them as a friend. It could be a neighbour, it could be someone that works at the shop or someone you see in the office but you don't actually work together with. And then you start to see this person after sending them meta and they start to appear like a friend and lo and behold, they start behaving friendly towards you. But it was very pure because you didn't expect that as a result. And so this is really interesting, but the mind can find it hard to stay with a neutral person simply because we're not invested in that person being in our lives. And then we move on to the disliked person, usually just for a short period of time at first, to see if the quality of metta changes, because it does start to change depending on the object at this point. And this is really interesting because it's also almost like the metta gets revved up because now it's reaching its aim of genuinely being used to overcome aversion. Right? So far, there's not been too much aversion, other than maybe towards yourself. But by the time it reaches the person that you don't like very much, it kind of has to increase. And the simile given here is like when we start with the easy person, it's like putting kindling on the fire. So it's like it very easily takes the flame. And then the next person's a little bit more difficult. So once it's taken the flame, then we put like branches, not really big branches on the fire, because the fire's already burning, right? So that's the next person. And then when we have a really nice fire, we can put some dry logs. And because the fire's already going, it takes the dry logs as well, and the fire becomes really, really warm. And only then you put on the difficult person. Not to burn them. But the difficult person is like a big, wet, sappy log. It really doesn't take the flame easily, right? So the fire has to be very hot. So we put the big, wet, sappy log on the flame. And then the fire goes, vroom! And if it's up to it, it takes the wet, sappy log and dries it out. So we don't do this until the fire's quite strong. And then we put on the difficult person. And at this point, the metta starts to become equivalent in every case. And this is wonderful. This is where we start to be able to indiscriminately spread loving kindness in every direction, just as it says in the suttas. But until then, it's very difficult to do. And it's a beautiful practice because it kind of combines a very systematic approach of thinking, using thought in a directed way, but also using intuition, emotional intuition. So we plant the thought, which is like putting on the kindling, and then we just listen to the heart. We just listen to our emotional world to see what kind of response arises and give it space, give it time. It's like fanning the flames or just letting the flames continue to increase with the oxygen of kindfulness. So this is how we practice. And gosh, there was a lot more I wanted to share, but I'll have to close pretty soon. So it's amazing how much you can talk about love and kindness, actually. Because one of the outcomes of this kind of love is that the mind is so much more resilient. And there's a lovely sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. And maybe I'll just read it out, because this will give you some idea of the benefits of this practice. And this is called the salt crystal, the simile of the salt. So, and it's in relation to karma. So basically the point of this sutta is that When we meet situations in life that are difficult, or even when we do things that are unskillful, they have an effect on the mind. But the extent of that effect depends on the condition of our mind. So if our mind is already very irritable, very tight, overburdened, tired, whatever it might be, full of ill will perhaps, and something happens, something small, somebody looks at you in a certain way, oh, you get angry. You know, the whole world seems to collapse. Or even if you do something that's unskillful and you already have a lot of bad karma, a lot of kind of negativity in your mind, it will have an effect. That karma will have an effect. But if you, that same thing happens to you when you're resourced, when your mind is full of loving kindness, the impact is very, very minimal. So we're actually changing, in a way, our karmic course. I don't really want to say destiny, but in a way, trajectory towards liberation. So the Buddha says, here, a person has created trifling bad karma, yet it leads them to hell, while another person has created exactly the same trifling karma. Trifling means very small amount of bad karma. Yet it is to be experienced in this very life without even the slight residue being seen, much less an abundant residue. What kind of person creates trifling bad karma that leads them to hell? Here, a person is undeveloped in body, in virtue, in mind, which means states of mind, samadhi states, and in wisdom. They are limited and have a mean character, and they dwell in suffering. When such a person creates trifling bad karma, it leads them to hell. And hell doesn't have to be a realm, right? It can be hell right now. What kind of person creates exactly the same trifling bad karma, and yet it is to be experienced in this very life without even a slight residue being seen, much less an abundant residue? Here, some person is developed in body, in virtue, in samadhi, and in wisdom. They are unlimited and have a lofty character, and they dwell without measure. Without measure in Pali is appamana, or it could be mahagata. It basically means the mind has gone to greatness, it has become boundless. And these same words are used when one practices loving kindness. It becomes a boundless abiding, it becomes immeasurable state of mind. When such a person creates exactly the same trifling bad karma, it's to be experienced in this very life without even a slight residue being seen, much less abundant residue. And then this is the simile of the salt. Suppose a person would drop a lump of salt into a small bowl of water. What do you think, monastics or community? Would that lump of salt make the small quantity of water in the bowl salty and undrinkable? What do you think? Yes, Bhante. For what reason? Because the water in the bowl is limited, thus that lump of salt would make it salty and undrinkable. But suppose a person would drop a lump of salt into the river Ganges. What do you think, community? Would that lump of salt make the river Ganges become salty and undrinkable? What do you think? No, Bhante. For what reason? Because the river Ganges contains a large volume of water, thus that lump of salt would not make it salty and undrinkable. So this is how it is when we have a lot of loving kindness. We can face the challenges in life, we can deal with negativity, even abuse. People will use words that hurt, people will say unkind things. But if our mind is full of loving kindness, it will hardly have any effect. And I had this experience myself with a memory that arose. I suppose you could say that's the old effects of old karma coming up. Not karma in the sense that I did something to deserve it, but just, you know, the results of something that had happened. So this was when I was practicing loving kindness many years ago, and mainly to the loved person, and the metta was flowing really strong, and the mind was bright and resourced and beautiful, and I was really enjoying myself. And I wasn't trying to share metta with the different groups. I was going to stay with the love person to see how far I could go. But then this memory of a very difficult person appeared in my mind. And normally when I thought about this person, I would get a trauma response because they had physically abused me in the past. And this time they came up and it was amazing. They just seemed to sort of dissolve into this big sea of loving kindness. It was so beautiful, a bit like that salt just dissolving. They came up, I didn't resist them, it didn't impact me, and then they disappeared. But I felt that they joined the flow in a sense. It was like there was this abundance there, this flow of love. And it felt like they just dipped right in. And from then on, I never had that same trauma response when I thought about them, and I could wish them well, truly wish them well. I still didn't directly practice loving kindness towards them because I felt the healing had happened. But if I think about them, I can think about them with love and truly wish them well. So these are some of the benefits of loving kindness. And of course, they will continue to extend into your life. You'll find you're more courageous. You can be more authentic because you have a deep sense of self-worth. You can be more transparent. You can admit your faults and mistakes. I love doing that. I really love doing that, actually, because I've seen it gives people a gift to be themselves. You know, if the senior monk or nun are always perfect and have it all together, it's no fun, is it? But one of the signs that somebody's moving towards stream winning is that they can't conceal the slightest mistake. They're transparent. They tell you if they're messed up. We don't do that because we're afraid of people's judgment, but most of the time we're just afraid of our own judgment, aren't we? We're just afraid of the inner critic. So when you have more loving kindness, you can be yourself, you can forgive yourself, you can make mistakes, you can be more courageous, you can take a risk, and you'll be dear to humans and to animals alike. And the devas will protect you. So develop lots of loving kindness throughout this retreat.